Oh, my gosh, what an introduction. Oh, can we just close the meeting and we all go home happy? I am Sharon Batchel, and I am a very grateful member of a worldwide fellowship called Al-Anon. Oh, look at all these people. This is just wonderful. And for me, one more time, how many people is this your first assembly? That's what keeps it going. Oh, I always have such a hard time getting started with my talk when I was sitting there and going, now how am I going to start? And the thing that just immediately popped into my mind, so many children who grew up in drinking homes say that the first emotion that they remember was fear. For me, it was guilt. I picked up all of that anger, all of that misery, all of the chaos that was going on, and I took responsibility for it. I figured if I had not come along, I was the last of three children, that my mother could have left and supported two children, and she wouldn't have had to stay there and been miserable, and he was miserable, and she was miserable, and he was miserable, and then it was all my fault. And I thought I didn't do anything right. I thought I wasn't pretty enough. I thought I wasn't smart enough. I thought I didn't do it quickly enough. I thought I did too much too often. I did too little too late. All of those things, and I picked them up very early. You know, it's not something that I learned, you know, in coping skills later in life. That's what I brought to every single relationship that I had. That's what I brought to my friendships, even as a child. That's what I brought to my adult relationships, and that's the person that I brought into the rooms of Al-Anon. There's nothing wrong with being responsible. I know that today, but I was overly responsible. That unearned guilt, you know, that there were starving children in China, that was my fault. You know, and it was very natural for me when I found myself in a drinking relationship and another drinking relationship, and they drank and they said it was my fault. You know, of course it was. You know, it rained. It was my fault. You know, I picked up on that. That was just very natural for me. I didn't have a close relationship with my father. He was the drinker in our home, but he was a binge drinker and a quiet binge drinker at that. He just wanted to drink and be left alone. So what he would do, he would drink and stay gone 2 or 3 days. And then he would come home, and then the fight would start. And I know they thought they were trying to keep this secret, but when there's that chaos, the kids know. We would wake up in the middle of the night, and we would hear it. I remember, though, that the arguments would be about money. It was never about alcohol. At least this isn't what registered with me, that the arguments were about alcohol. I remember the arguments of how could you spend the paycheck doing this when we needed groceries, when we needed to pay the mortgage, and I related all of this that it was money problems. I never picked up that it was alcohol, even though there was always a bottle in the house, there was always beer in the refrigerator. Never occurred to me that that was the problem. My father would work nights. It was another excuse, you know, stay out of the picture, you know, don't get in the line of fire, because my mother was the one that heaped on the verbal abuse. And I just didn't have a relationship with him. I looked at him as a boarder. And she never said anything kind or loving about him or to him, never encouraged me to have a loving relationship with him, and I didn't. That was my pattern. You know, this is the angry person. This is the person I want to please. This is the person I want to placate. And, you know, she was the one writing the rules, so that's what I tried to do. The only thing, though, when the drinking is there, whoever is doing it, those rules shift. You know, it's like trying to stand on quicksand. It can't be done. I thought, okay, if I do this today, then, and it's okay, then if I do it tomorrow, it's okay. Well, no, it wasn't. Sometimes it'd be half an hour later and it wouldn't be okay. But I had so much emptiness in my life because it wasn't a loving relationship with my mother either. And I didn't have a father in essence. The insanity with my brother and sister, and it was just very empty. And I needed a way to fill that. I needed something. And an uncle and aunt, they were both very kind, very loving, took a great interest in me, would take me places, do things with me. And when I was alone with my uncle, he would hold me and snuggle me and touch me. And if it felt wrong, I stuffed it. I just said, nope, there's nothing wrong with this, that he loves me and he's fond of me and he's showing me. And this was the man in my life. This was, that filled that void, that took my father's place. And all of the ugly feelings, I said, this is okay, I'll swallow it, I'll stuff it. Which was another pattern I got into, you know, that at all costs, I'll keep the peace, and if there is anything I can get out of it, if there's something yucky, I'll just ignore it, and I'll go on just so I can have that little bit of something, you know, that trying to fill that emptiness from outside instead of inside. This went on for a few years until I reached my early teens. And then my uncle, one weekend, it was a family outing, and he took me aside, and he explained exactly what he expected of where our relationship was to go from there. And I was frightened, and I knew it was wrong, and I managed to get away from him and make sure I was never alone with him again. And I went to my mother, and I told her that I had been having these icky feelings and what he had said, and she says, but nothing really happened, did it? And I went, well, no. You know, if that's what you mean, no, that didn't happen. And she says, then nothing really happened, and you just misunderstood. And I sucked it in, and I told myself nothing really happened, and I remained angry with my mother for about 25 years. But I kept stuffing it. I said, nothing really happened. This is, we'll go on. We'll never talk about this again. But those things, I found for me, if I don't deal with them, they keep coming up. They keep crawling out. And I'll get to that later on when this crawls back out again, outside of all of the other unhealthy ways that I acted out with my own experimenting with drugs and alcohol and men and Eastern philosophies and this, you know, all of those things that I kept trying to cram in there. And I, you know, I was thinking this evening before I came down to the meeting room, those serious relationships that I had with men before I married my husband, the first serious relationship, he was absolutely opposed to any kind of drinking whatsoever, because his mother had told him this was a bad thing. Well, his grandfather was in Alcoholics Anonymous. That might explain some of that. The next serious relationship that I had, we dated for several years, and we broke up. He moved out of state, and I found out from a mutual friend that he died in a one-car accident while he was under the influence of alcohol. Well, this is a surprise. And then the next serious relationship, I'm married to him. Still, it amazes me. It's going to be 25 years in March. Gosh darn. You know, this program does work miracles. But I met the love of my life in a bar. You know, the joke goes, I stepped on his hand. But this is where I socialized. This is what I knew. I had been around drinkers all my life. You know, whether, you know, my father had crossed that line into alcoholism, I don't know. I do know his drinking and his behavior and his neglect bothered me, which qualifies me for this program right there. I know now, looking back, a lot of those episodes with my uncle, when I think about those, I can smell the alcohol still. Now, I don't know, had he crossed that line into alcoholism? I I can't answer that for him. But I know that these were my attractions. And I knew that the man that I married would have to drink to fit in with my family. You know, and people that knew him when we started to date, they'd look at me and say, you know, Sharon, he's an alcoholic. And I'm going, no, he's not. You just don't understand him. You know, I love the line from Lois Remembers where she says, I thought living with me would be such an inspiration. He wouldn't need to drink. Yeah, I identified with that. That this is what he needed was somebody to love him and take care of him and watch after him and clean up his messes and all of those things that I wanted to do for an alcoholic that made it comfortable for him to drink. And that's exactly what I did. From almost the very first date, I started doing that. Picking up after him, making excuses for him, covering up for him, you know, fixing things, you know, changing my moods, changing my behavior, changing my appearance, just so he wouldn't be upset and he wouldn't drink. Now, he was a very different kind of drinker than what I was used to. He was a daily drinker, and I had never experienced that. And he explained to me that he couldn't possibly have a drinking problem if he drank daily and he could still hold down a job. Now, okay, this was with my belief system. You know, I thought an alcoholic was somebody who drank rot gut wine and slept in a gutter by the bus station. You know, that was my definition. I had absolutely no idea that 95% of alcoholics are functional. At some level of, or another, you know, they can hold a job, they can pay a mortgage, that they still have a family, they still have a social life, you know, that everything out there looks okay. And, you know, everything out there on this man looked okay. You know, he was intelligent, he was successful, he was attractive, and, oh, he was jealous. Oh. That just thrilled me no end. You know, if another man even so much as looked at me, he went ballistic. And, you know, that was the final kicker. You know, I wanted him for my very own. Now, we had a rocky relationship, of course. And, you know, I said that it was his idea. And my husband says it was my idea to get married. But I think God decided to fix two people at the same time and had a lot to do with that. I think I'm finally over the resentment about our wedding night. We had a suite and we slept in two separate rooms. I just won't go into any other details about that. But Larry would have blackouts when he drank and have no clue what happened the next day. Sometimes he would hit me when he was in a blackout. The first serious episode of that, I called the police and I had him locked up. And he promised me that that would never happen again, that he would never drink that much again, that he couldn't possibly imagine what caused him to do that, you know, outside of maybe he'd mix different types of alcohol, you know, always looking for that other reason, you know, outside of I'm screwed up. And I believed him. Of course I did. Now let's play it again. We'll dance to it. I had been accepting all of this garbage all of my life and had been in this denial about alcohol all my life. Sure, you know, hey, tell me this. You know, it's easier for me to believe that than to do something about myself. That was the bottom line. We had kind of a little honeymoon there for 2 or 3 months. He got incredibly drunk again, and he hit me again, and I had him locked up again. Somehow I knew this wasn't okay. Now, where I got that from, I don't know. Outside of it was a gift from God. That is the only explanation that I can come to with that. That I knew him hitting me was not okay. That was unacceptable. That either he was going to do something about his temper. Still didn't know it was the drinking. And stop hitting me, or I would have to leave him. Now, we'd been married 5 months. You know, I was an accident waiting to happen. And after I had him locked up that second time, and I was at the Justice of the Peace signing the warrant, and, you know, I asked him, can you recommend an attorney? And he says, well, we really can't do that. And a woman overheard me, and she walked up, and she says, I'm swearing out a warrant against my ex-husband. Let me give you the card of the attorney that handled my divorce. So I made an appointment, and I went to see him, and I told him my whole sad story of how miserable I was, and this man was making me miserable. It was all his fault. You know, if he would just clean up his act, I would be fine. Yeah, you know, I had also been saying that all my life. If you would just clean up your act, I would be okay. You know, I don't need to fix me. You know, I need to fix you. And he poured out all of this sadness to him of my misery and, you know, that my husband was causing it. And he made no notes. As I recall, he just sat there like this, staring at me across the desk, and he looked at me and says, your husband is an alcoholic, and it's up to him whether or not he gets help, but you need help. And I was dumbstruck. The word alcoholic registered. I went, oh, my God, this is a total stranger. And from what I just told him, that this is what he thinks the problem is. And then I was also insulted about how dare he say I needed help. What I needed was a divorce. You know, that's why I came here, that he was supposed to tell me what my rights were and that we were supposed to sign the papers and, you know, that this was going to solve my problem one more time. And he did none of those things that I had expected. And he says, we're not going to file any paperwork today. I want you to think about this and consider it. And if you want to pursue in legal action, you come back and you see me. And I walked out of there having absolutely no hope and thinking I had nowhere to turn for help. And fortunately, Larry traveled a lot with his job at the time. We wouldn't have lasted 5 months. But he was out of town, and I was home, and the television was on. I don't think I was watching it. But an Al-Anon commercial came on, and it said, you can see what their drinking is doing to them, but can you see what it's doing to you? And I went, that's right! See what he's doing to me? Well, yeah, hey, close. It got me to call Al-Anon and ask where to find a meeting. And I did, and I found a meeting, and I went. And I walked in, and I tell this story in such detail because I look at all the miracles that happened, and in the order that they happened, that I got here and I stayed here, because I walked in to that first meeting, and it was on the first step. And people were talking about exactly how crazy I felt. I did not feel powerless, but I felt unmanageable. That I had tried so hard to make myself in to what everybody else wanted so that they would make me happy. That, you know, that just doesn't sound sane. When I say that out loud, anytime I say that out loud, it doesn't sound sane. But I was so blessed walking into that meeting. This was also a meeting that believed in temporary sponsors. But they didn't out and out say that they were assigning a temporary sponsor. What they did was that after the meeting, that someone came up to me on a one-to-one basis and handed me a piece of literature, and she introduced herself and gave me her phone number. She says, if you want to talk, call me. Oh, my gosh, somebody was actually willing to listen to me. There was nobody I knew that wanted to hear it anymore. And she was willing to listen until I called her. I called her often, and I ranted, and I raved, and I complained, and I whined, and I cried, and all of the things that so many of us have said when we're dealing with an alcoholic. And it was, you know, how do I get him straightened out? Or how do I leave him so I'll be okay? You know, it was not what I could do for me. And she was very patient. And she pointed out things to me like, keep it simple. If you find you're in a rough spot, repeat the Serenity Prayer. And I'm going, okay, maybe if I do this stuff, then she'll tell me the secret. You know, whatever the secret is. You know, I have to pass all these tests first. And, you know, I started to feel better. I started to do just a little bitty thing, and I felt better. So I did the next little bitty thing, and I felt better. And I kept going to meetings, and I kept using the phone list. And I got a sponsor within the first few months. Of course, I wound up on her doorstep in the middle of the night, you know, crying jag that, you know, he was drinking and it is well. Okay. But, you know, I had a sponsor. And I am so grateful to her today because she's the reason that I do service work. She did not have a service title at any time I knew her. But she volunteered in the institution's meeting. She volunteered for the answering service. She volunteered at the Atlanta office. It was way before it was called Mays. But she did those things, and she taught me that this is how we get better in this program. As soon as we can give something back, we start giving back. I know I felt like I was totally inadequate, and a newcomer came in the room one night, and she pushed me towards them. Said, I don't have anything to share with them. And she says, you can hand them a piece of literature and welcome them to the meeting. And those were the things that I learned. It didn't have to be the big mountaintop miracles that I thought, you know, the bolt of lightning, the clap of thunder, you know, the flash of blue light. I have never had that in my program. You know, it's the little twinklings and another little twinkling. And I'll turn around and go, oh, that was you. You know, and recognize those coincidences for what they are. That a coincidence is just God's way of keeping his anonymity. And I will add that it has been a struggle for me to have a higher power of my understanding. And when I say God and he, it's strictly for convenience. It doesn't put a definition on who or what or how. It's just, I know that I have a power greater than myself that acts in my life today. In learning those things and getting grounded with somebody who was so dedicated to the program and so dedicated to giving back was just such a gift. Somewhere in this, I don't know if he wanted to check up on me, if he really wanted some kind of recovery, I don't know. Larry started going to meetings. And he'd pick up a white chip and he'd go and drink, and he'd pick up a white chip and he'd go and drink. And at some point, he just quit picking up white chips, but he kept going to meetings, which is okay, because I've learned that, at least for me, and I saw it work for him, that sitting in enough meetings, something sinks in by osmosis, if nothing else. And there was a slow and gradual change that I started to see in him. Drinking wasn't daily anymore. Sometimes it wasn't weekly. Sometimes it'd be a couple of months. And I learned to be grateful for the periods without the alcohol and try not to count on those as sobriety. I guess I've been in the program maybe about 3 years, and I knew that I wanted to do more with the program. That I wanted to do service beyond the group level. And my group needed a GR. And I said, oh, well, what would you have to do? And they say, you'll be in Macon next weekend. So many people, I found that this is how they get, oh, well, what would I have to do? Oh, well, glad you volunteered. In fact, I think I volunteered a few people that way. But I did. I started coming to assemblies. I started going to district meetings. I got a service sponsor. I started to learn how this program works on a worldwide level. that it wasn't just the two or three meetings that I was sitting in. You know, this literature that I thought had been magically appearing came from somewhere. You know, this dollar I was putting in the basket or $2 I was putting in the basket went somewhere, and more people came in the room later on. So, and it was so wonderful for me to see that on that much bigger scope. And shortly after I became a GR, elections came around for DR in our district. And started around the table, can you stand? No, you know, I have a new baby. Can you stand? No, I work 60 hours a week. Can you stand? And he gets around to me and going, I'm not working right now, but I don't think I can do it. Oh, great, Sherrod, I'm so glad you volunteered. So that's how I got the job of DR, about the same way I got the job of GR. And I knew the newly elected delegate, so I got another job. I wound up as a coordinator for the assembly. And that was another wonderful gift. I was newsletter editor. And reading all of those sharings that came from all over Georgia and some of the exciting things that were going on in your districts and that were going on with other coordinators, with PI and CPC and institutions and Alleting, and reading newsletters from other areas and things they were doing. And that was just amazing to me, of all of these people that were doing these things for fun and for free. And I was part of that. I'm going, golly, how did I get this lucky? But it was a good 3 years. I know I went off to a lot of service meetings, and this was something really important that I wanted to mention, because it was when I finally understood about my husband's drinking. I had a service meeting to go to one night. And I was getting ready to leave, and I turned around and I looked at him, and I said, well, what are you going to do? And he says, I'm going to clean up and go to a meeting. Well, I got home 3 hours later, and he was drunk. And I knew not to initiate a conversation then. I waited until the next morning, and I looked at him, and I said, what happened? And he gave me an honest answer, I think, for the first time. He looked at me and says, I don't know. And I understood. He didn't know any more than I did why he had to drink, except that it's an illness. And, you know, that itch for which there is no scratch, the itch went away. It didn't matter anymore. He drank because he was an alcoholic. But as the end of the 3-year term was coming up, elections were coming up for officers, and I was encouraged to think about standing for an office. And I said, I don't know, you know, the same thing, all that inadequacy, you know, that low self-esteem, you know, that, and I know nobody ever believes that, but that's, you know, and I still get attacks of that. I guess those people who've sat in a lot of meetings with me believe it, but I said, no, I can't do that. He says, oh, well, yes, you can. So I thought about it. I said, okay, all right, then I will stand, and, you know, I'll stand for delegate. I'll put my name in there, and, you know, and I'll put my name in for alternate and those. And I figured, well, I'll never get elected delegate, because the alternate delegate was very popular, very funny, you know, very charming person that I think everyone expected to get elected the new delegate. And she didn't even show up for the election assembly. Look at that weekend. And the amount of growth that I got from that experience, I can't explain to you all of it. There are some very significant things that happened, though, in my recovery, in the learning to let go of all of that past anger and all of that garbage that I had been carrying around in that sack with me, and, you know, keeping that wall between me and the people that I said I loved. So at some point in this, I turned around and I looked at my mother, and I, because my father had died several years before, he just, you know, he drank, he smoked, he ate wrong, he didn't exercise, it killed him. You know, that's just what happens. But she was my only parent, and I thought to myself, I said, well, am I going to spend the rest of her life being angry with her? Or am I going to try to look beyond that and have a relationship with her? So I thought, well, I can at least try to get to know her. You know, I can try to have a mother-daughter relationship with her. And it was little stuff. We would talk about the weather. We would talk about the funny TV program. We would talk about the magazine article. It was all of those safe things that we would talk about and continue to talk about an awful lot. We didn't discuss feelings with each other. You know, she wanted to deny that anything bad ever happened, and, you know, I wanted to fix her, and so, you know, we didn't get into a lot of that. But I stopped being angry with her. I said, that's just what happened. And as I was starting to build this relationship with her, and here I am, delegate, and there's starting to be a lot of material in the forum and a lot of mail coming to WSO about the problems of child abuse in an alcoholic home. And that it just goes hand in hand. The statistics are terrible. That if a child is molested, that it's 65% of the time drugs or alcohol are involved. And those were the things that I was learning. And it was something that I had to finally face. That no, the sex act didn't take place, but yes, something really did happen. And I had been molested. I had been taken advantage of. He was an adult. I was a child, probably as young as 4 or 5 when it started. And I had no responsibility in that. And again, I had taken every bit of the responsibility. You know, I had misunderstood, and don't need to go over that again. I think you all get the idea. But I started to remember those things, and I started to read these letters, and I was in such agony with this. I said, now how can I function as a trusted servant and try to carry this message of hope when I can't deal with this problem myself? So I sought someone out in the program that I had heard share about this being a problem with her. And she says, well, my case was a little different, but I know someone that you know that went through almost identical situation. And it turns out it was my service sponsor. And she had never mentioned it to me. And we had a lot of heart-to-hearts, and I talked it out, and I cried it out, and I was able to forgive him and let go of it and forgive my mother. Because she didn't know how to handle it. And the gift of that, after I'd let go of all that anger, you know, I always want to know why. You know, tell me why. Maybe if I understood, I'd feel better about it. It'd still be crappy, but I'd feel better about it. And we were out, did one of our shopping trips or out to lunch or something one day. And we had the radio on, and we were just chit-chatting, and the news comes on, and they're talking about a child molestation trial that was very high profile in our county, and, you know, where the latest, you know, proceedings were. And my mother reached over and clipped off the radio, and she says, you know, that happened to me when I was a child. And it was all I could do to keep from crying right there with her. It made me understand why she couldn't cope, that why she couldn't do anything about it. I guess in a lot of ways today that I am grateful that she didn't, because it would have devastated the family, that my uncle has been gone for several years now, and I don't have a lot of family left. I have my sister and I have my aunt, and I know I wouldn't have my aunt if there had been a big blow-up with this. You know, things happen for a reason. Oh, did I mention to you that Larry hasn't had a drink in 19 years? Yes. Just about out of time. Good point to end this on. There's some way that gets lost in my talk because my focus isn't him anymore. His sobriety is not my responsibility. You know, the miracle is that he, for him, is he doesn't drink. My miracle is I can be down here and not worry if he's drinking. And when I get home, I don't have to smell his breath. I don't have to check the trunk for bottles. It amazes me that I can live like this, that I can live happy, joyous, and free. And I got that from all of you. And I am so eternally grateful for the opportunities that I have had to serve this fellowship, because I wouldn't have learned what I have learned about me. Thank you.